from Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some topics to talk about.
Zorba. Yes, we're going to talk about vaping again. Vaping and the problems with vaping. I've been against vaping since the very beginning, saying there's nothing like fresh air to go into your lungs. And we're discovering that is indeed true. And we're going to talk about sex, the shape of the penis during coitus, and whether or not that might actually have a bearing on fertility and other aspects associated with the sexual act. We are public radio people, so we can do this in a scientific and moderately appropriate way.
If you say so.
And I do.
And what's our recipe?
Mediterranean baked feta with olives and tomatoes. It's wonderful. It's delicious. And, of course, it is healthy.
Still thinking about one of those topics. To the phones we go now, Zorba. 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Let's welcome our first caller, a listener with us in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Hi.
How are you today?
Fine. How can we help?
So one of my favorite things to do is pick berries.
Mm-hmm.
So as part of that, I end up with an extremely large freezer full of berries if I'm not careful.
Mm-hmm.
So over the years, I've been thinking about ways that I can actually utilize those to get the most nutritional value.
Mm-hmm.
And my question has to do with whether or not it is, do I get more nutritional value out of the berries by dehydrating them and utilizing them in forms that have to do with either powders or as dried berries, or cooking them down and using low sugar recipes for jam, or just making compotes?
Right. Actually, these are really good questions. So let me go a little bit backwards as to what we're actually getting out of these, you know, out of berries. So first of all, we're getting fiber. So whatever we do with fiber, although we alter it, when we're all done, we still have fiber in there. And then we have vitamins. Vitamins are very heat sensitive. Some are more heat sensitive than others. So, for instance, if you have canned vegetables, not berries, but canned vegetables or berries where you're boiling them, you're actually destroying a lot of the vitamins. You're not destroying some of the micronutrients. You're certainly not destroying the elements that are in there because they can't be destroyed by heating. But you are destroying some of that. And then the question is, how are we actually using them? What about the sugars? We don't get rid of the sugars. No matter what we do, the carbohydrate in the berry is the same. So if you flash freeze them, in other words, if you take them and you blanch them, you're going to keep the most vitamins in them. Blanch them and freeze them and they're good. Now, I don't know about dehydrating the berry. I have no idea whether or not dehydrating preserves the vitamins and the minerals. For that, I would go to Dr. Google because I think Dr. Google may have that. But I would end up going probably to a website that would be run by the state agricultural's people in Wisconsin, because I don't know about the dehydration.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about two berries in particular, so elderberries, which we know is a superfruit. But when you try to actually utilizing those fresh isn't the best. You can turn it into a juice, but then you have concentrated sugars in that capacity. When I powderize it, I can get out the seeds, which are a complication, and then I can use, say, like a tablespoon of that powder in, say, energy drinks, or I add them to my granola bars as a slight, taste that it adds like a lemony tinge and a sweetener. And the same goes for the black raspberries and the red raspberries. They, when they dry, they do not have like the texture that you get from a cherry or a blueberry where you'd want to actually use that in granola. But they really add a wonderful taste. And so what you're saying about the micronutrients, that's something that, and the antioxidants is also a question compared to the balance of, like you said, the the carbohydrates and
let me zero back to this. So first of all, let's assume that some of the micronutrients are destroyed, which I think they are, and some are still there. The issue is, how are we utilizing that for our health? So when you're putting this into either a good granola bar or you're putting it into a smoothie, you are eating better than if you just go and grab, we'll say, Tropicana orange juice and you have 12 ounces, you know, which is really mostly sugar. It has got some vitamin C, but it's really a very sugary drink. So it's really, if this improves the utilization of something that is healthy to you and you're then eating better, then that's, if you will, the side benefit of utilizing it versus putting in 2 teaspoons of sugar. So the indirect usefulness is that it then encourages you to eat better. For
and
that, I can say
it's
really
summer.
Right, outside. And also reminds you of the middle of the summer. You feel good eating it, increases the endorphins. You go, hey, I did this in the summertime. I look forward to it. Because the reality is a lot of berries are not seasonal in the wintertime. And we get them from foreign countries like Mexico and Costa Rica and Chile because we want to have berries in the middle of the winter. But actually, if we look at eating in a natural way, we would only have strawberries during strawberry season. And the rest of the time, if we had strawberries, it would only be either in a compote in a freezer or in a jam. So, and there may be something with only eating strawberries during strawberry season versus year-round. We don't even think about that. Mm-hmm. The fact that we have perishables year-round that we never had, maybe that's actually not good for us. Maybe we should only be eating seasonably. You know, and what you're doing may actually be good for your body because you're not having the regular fruit at the time in the middle of the winter.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of my goal in mm-hmm. eating out of my garden in the woods is eating locally and seasonally.
Yeah,
so
I love
and
it.
The counter to that is the freezer. Then you are utilizing extra electricity throughout
right.
the year to
right.
hold. So that's where I said, well, those two options are uh-huh. compote or, you know, dehydration. So thank you so much for your answer.
You know, it's very interesting. So when we're utilizing electrons that we don't need that may come from other sources such as natural gas or coal, how does that affect the food that we're actually eating? And when you mm-hmm. look at Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, which was a great book, his goal was to actually eat in a totally organic way and get away from industrialization. And if you've never read the book, it's an amazing read because it actually is almost impossible to get away from non-industrialization and be completely pure within our society because even the seeds have an element of industrialization to it. I love the idea of dehydration, using it, and reminding you in the winter about your summer garden. Good for the endorphins, good for your body, and good for your soul.
Thank you.
You're mm-hmm. welcome. Thanks for your sharing.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413, our number. But Zorba, before our next call, we've heard of Sex in the City, but you're going to talk about Sex in the Scanner.
Right, right. So, you know, at first blush, we might think that, this was a study done 20 years ago in the BMJ. It's been downloaded numerous times, and it was people who had coitus, had intercourse in an MRI scanner, and they were actually looking to see whether or not the shape of the penis was different. Now, we might look at this and say, what is this study about, and does it have any scientific merit? But we've got to look in the realm of the fact that there are a number of people who have difficulty conceiving children, mm-hmm. and we don't do research on this. We just assume, for instance, that it has to do with the number of sperm per cc. Once you get below 10 million sperm per milliliter of semen, that leads to infertility. But it actually might be the shape of the penis, and it might be how coitus is actually done, might actually affect whether or not you can have children. So let's look at the study for mm-hmm. a second. And mm-hmm. I think we can do this in an appropriate scientific way. We might say, ho, 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 what is Sex in the Scanner about? But there's an important issue here in that we actually don't look at these issues scientifically because we're afraid, because we're often a puritanical society, and we don't want to look at this. So first of all, they took roughly a dozen subjects, and they had them put them in an MRI scanner and had them have sex. Well, you can imagine, it had to be a little difficult to have sex in the missionary position.
I can't even imagine.
No.
Would you be able to do that?
No.
So I don't think they had
subjects who were able to actually do this. Mm-hmm. And remember, this is in the pre-Viagra, pre-Cialis era, and there's important issues here. And also, these were young subjects who were more likely to have sex with, say, than older subjects. Yeah. Put them in an MRI scanner. They were looking at the shape of the penis, the shape of the penis during coitus, during actually when there was ejaculation, was thought to be sort of straight and rigid, or is thought to be thought to be sort of a different shape, an S shape. Turned out to be more the shape of a boomerang. So in other words, when ejaculation occurred, the shape of the penis changed. Okay. And so you go, oh, well, there was a difference in the shape of the penis, and you may laugh at it. It's more like a boomerang versus straight. The issues, I think, is does the shape of the penis during ejaculation have any issue with the quality of the sperm that come out of the penis and whether or not there are enough swimmers to actually produce fertility in a couple that has infertility? In other words, we assume it's just the number of sperm per cc, but it also may be the shape of the penis affects how the sperm actually come out.
Did they figure it out? Did it work? I mean,
No. This was 20 years ago, so there was no Viagra or Cialis, and we don't know whether or not drugs like Viagra and Cialis actually affect the shape of the penis during the act of ejaculation. We know that it makes it easier for a man to actually have tumescence and actually produce a penis that is rigid enough to have intercourse, especially in men who are not able to. But we have never really tested it, men who do not need Viagra to actually have intercourse, to see whether or not it affects the shape of the penis and whether or not it actually affects fertility. So we may, as I said, laugh and say, oh, this is a funny study. And in some ways it is. It is one of the most, if not the most downloaded study in the BMJ. But we haven't looked at these drugs and whether or not these drugs are actually useful or affect the shape of the penis and whether or not that affects fertility. And so, although this received 20 years ago the Ignoble Science Award, which used to be the Golden Fleece Award of Bill Proxmire of Wisconsin, of how could we spend money on scientific experiments that have no merit, this study may have scientific merit now and in the future and may be useful in fertility and should be redone. But because we are a puritanical society, we don't want to touch on subjects such as this because we're afraid to do it. And frankly, the NIH is afraid to fund it.
But they never did find anything.
Well, they never actually looked at this on the basis of fertility and whether or not drugs that help with which actually change the ability of a man to actually have an erection affect fertility in a positive way and whether or not shape is an issue and whether or not the sperm are viable or not viable. And also, they didn't check different positions. They only did one position.
Yeah.
Will a different position of having coitus actually make it more likely that you are going to have fertility? What we've done is you spend all this money and in vitro, which is $10,000 a crack, right? It's very, very expensive. But we haven't spent research looking at different positions of couples having sex to see whether or not a different position will actually make it more likely that you are going to have a child by a more natural method.
Interesting.
And that's what we need research for.
800-462-7413 is our number. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, good day to you. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I've got a question. I have, over the years, put on a little bit of weight and gained some pounds, and my doctor has recommended the Mediterranean diet.
Mm-hmm.
So in Googling that, I just see a whole lot of ads and a lot of, information out there. So I figured I'd call you and see if you had any books that you would recommend or recipes or something like that.
Oh, sure.
For the Mediterranean diet.
Let's look at the study that sort of even keyed this off a number of years ago. So people along the Mediterranean Sea do not have the American Heart Association cardboard diet. They eat well. They eat cheese. They eat certain fruits. They have occasional pastries, but they eat differently than we do. And if you look at the really study that was done, which looked at thousands of people, and half of them were on the enriched Mediterranean diet, which included a handful of nuts and a couple of ounces of olive oil, and people who were basically on the cardboard diet, they found it was impossible for people to follow the cardboard, American Heart Association cardboard diet, unless they were obsessive compulsive. And the med diet was easy to follow, and the drop in heart disease was dramatic. And that's really what drove it forward. So the med diet, Mediterranean diet, the king of diets, basically has protein in smaller amounts. It has plentiful fruits and vegetables, usually perishables that are out there. It has nuts and seeds. It may have some peanuts in it, but for the most part, they're tree nuts and seeds, often with a glass of wine that's in there too, and fish once or twice a week. That's really the Mediterranean diet. If you look it up, it's great. And there are a number of great books. I mean, The Mediterranean Diet for Beginners is one great book. The Complete Book of Mediterranean Diet is good. The 30-Minute Mediterranean Diet is an excellent book. If you go to Amazon.com, you can find some good books. Or go to your local bookstore and talk to the person behind the counter, and they will recommend some good books. The Complete Mediterranean Cookbook, 500 Vibrant Kitchen-Tested Recipes for Living and Eating Well Every Day. I love all these books. Why are you changing to a different med diet? Just because of heart disease you're concerned about, or is it a weight issue?
Overweight and blood pressure. I own a restaurant, so I always have to do
quality
control. And
what kind of restaurant do you own?
It's fast food, fried chicken.
Uh-huh.
So really hard to taste.
Yeah, well, you've got to taste it. You know, you have to be able to do it. I have to tell you, so recently my wife and I were in Europe, and the first thing that impresses you when you walk around France and Spain and the UK is how thin the people are. They're really not heavy. And the second thing that impresses you is when you go to a restaurant and you buy and you eat food, there's smaller amounts on the plate. So, you know, even when it comes to you're doing quality control fried food, the issue is how much are you actually eating? So I occasionally, in Wisconsin, we have bratwurst, and I just want a brat. And I go across the street to our local convenience store, and their brats they're not that good. They're not as good as a Johnsonville brat on the grill in the summer or in the winter outside watching a Packer game. But I got to have a brat. And the first thing I do when I get my brat, when I do it, is I take half of it and I throw it out. Because I just feel like the taste of a brat. I don't need to have all that fat, but I really want to have it. But I don't want the whole brat. So I'm now eating half the number of calories. When you do your quality control in your restaurant, I think you ought to think about it that way as you're getting the more med diet. Because you got to taste it. But you got to taste it, but you don't have to finish the whole piece. So you may want to break it in half, throw half of it away. And that may be part of your weight control.
Well, that's great advice. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. You should take Penny along. Then you could split the brat.
But she doesn't eat brat, but you know what she did? She looked at the brat and she said, "Why are you giving me this brat?"
800-462-7413, our number. Before we take a break, Zorba, time again now to waltz our way through the murky waters of medical quackery in another segment of Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba. But wait, Zorba. There's also a Google Doc element to the following.
Okay.
So we're going to mash up these two segments and call it Quacking Up with Google Doc.
Quack it up.
Google Doc. Google Doc.
I love it. It's the combo music, the combo brain.
A listener, Mark in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, wrote the following. I recently saw an ad for Professor Dr. Cord's Electric Eye Warmer in an exhibit at the University of Pennsylvania Library. I Googled Dr. Cord's and found nothing, but I saw a lot of electric eye masks for sale. Is there a benefit to this?
Electric eye mask? You mean electric eye mask? Electric eye mask? What's the benefit to an electric eye mask? I'm just trying to picture you have an eye mask and you've got electricity, so what's it going to do?
Maybe it warms up.
Maybe it warms up. Yeah, that's it. But what about the shocking? It's sort of a shocking, shocking thing you have. So I have to comment on the electric eye mask. You know, there's some things that are just beyond the scope of science that are just what I call in the common sense arena. So I will say the electric eye mask. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to turf it to you, Tom. What do you think about the electric eye mask?
Well, I'd sure like to give it a try, just for fun.
Just for fun. That's exact. So that's our answer. If you want to try it, try it for recreation.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or, of course, through Facebook.
A tasty recipe coming up along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, Mediterranean baked feta with olives and tomatoes.
You know, I can tell from the way you pronounced all those words that this is just a mouth-watering recipe for you.
I think I'd like it without the olives.
Yeah, without the olives. Oh, you're not an olive person.
Oh, no. I'm,
really?
Yes.
Oh, gosh. I love olives. I love all different kinds of olives. Green olives, black olives, olives that are cured.
Well, you're easy to please.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm pretty easy to please. I mean, I eat a lot of different stuff, but I love olives. So you could do feta with tomatoes. Do you like the taste of feta cheese?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So we could do this. You could do a recipe like this and leave out the olives. Yeah. It would be, for me, not as good, but it would also be very tasty.
Yeah.
So let's go to it. So wonderful recipe. Good any time of year. Good for a dish to pass, you know, if you're going to have some sort of a potluck. I really like potlucks because everyone tries to bring in their favorite dish. You know, and in Wisconsin, it's always the 10, 12, 14, 16 bean casserole. So it's got all these beans and layers. Start out with a roughly 10 to 11 ounces of Greek feta.
10 to 11 ounces Greek feta.
Yeah, you know, I never had feta cheese until I was an adult. You know, my mother believed in Kraft Singles American cheese, and for a variety, she would get generic Kraft Singles American cheese. Well, and that was it. We never had even cheddar cheese in our house.
Was there any feta back then?
Well, not in our grocery stores. There wasn't feta. Yeah, you probably had. You know what? In Chicago, you had to go to a specialty grocery store to get feta. It certainly was not ubiquitous like it is now. You can get it pretty much in any good grocery store is going to have feta. 10 to 11 ounces of feta. 2 to 3 cups of cherry tomatoes.
2 to 3 cups cherry tomatoes.
If you like olives, as I do, a cup of your choice. Might be green olives, might be Kalamata olives, it might be a variety of olives, but about a cup of olives.
Cup of olives.
Quarter of a cup of thinly sliced red onions.
Quarter cup thinly sliced red onions.
You're going to use the zest and the juice of a lemon.
Zest and juice of a lemon.
You're going to use 2 to 3 cloves of garlic, thinly sliced.
2 to 3 cloves garlic, thinly sliced.
2 to 3 sprigs of basil.
2 to 3 sprigs of basil.
2 to 3 sprigs of oregano.
2 to 3 sprigs of oregano.
1/2 cup to 1 cup of extra virgin olive oil.
1/2 to 1 cup extra virgin olive oil.
For heat, you're going to do 1 tablespoonful of chili flakes. Those are the chili flakes that you use on pizza. They give heat and nothing else.
Big T, chili flakes.
You're going to use some kosher salt and good freshly ground pepper to taste.
S&P to taste.
So preheat your oven to 400 degrees. Place the feta blocks in an oven-safe dish. So you're going to get feta blocks when you're getting a package of that. Pile the olives and cherry tomatoes on top of the feta blocks. If it doesn't all fit, you can place some tomatoes on top of the olives. But anyway, you don't worry about even double layering it. You're basically going to put the olives and the tomatoes on top of the feta. Place lemon peel or the zest and the red onions and garlic slices and herbs on top of the feta and olive and tomato mixture. Then take, whisk some olive oil and lemon juice together and pour all over this whole thing. Chili flakes on the top, S&P on the top. Bake for 20 to 30 minutes until that cheese is nice and softened and the tomatoes are roasted, and then bring it immediately to the table and serve it with some really good bread to soak up that olive oil mixture as you basically put it on your little dish. It's going to be bursting with flavor. You're going to want to eat this with
this. My mouth is actually watering.
You're going to want to eat this. It really, really is good. And you've got to serve it hot because you want the whole thing to be warm. And it's really, you know, when you think about it, it's sort of a variation on, we serve mac and cheese with cheese and macaroni. And what we're doing is we're doing feta and veggies. You know, the tomatoes in this case and olives. So if you want a copy, we used to send this hard copy in the mail with a stamp that Gigi would put up. Gigi was our person who did this, our volunteer. It was great. But now we've got a more electronic way of doing this. And if they you wonder what that is. I think if you go to ZorbaPastor.org, you can certainly write us. But ZorbaPastor.org, you can look at pictures of Tom, pictures of me. You You can look at pictures of this, pull down this recipe and other recipes at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us through Facebook.
Don't let the picture of me, send you away.
Send you away in no time. You'll get people who want autographs all the time.
800-462-7413 is our number, 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, back to the phones. We welcome a listener in Republic, Missouri. Hi.
Hi. Hi, guys.
How can we help?
Well, my question today has to do with the onset of menopause, specifically wanting to know if diet can affect the symptoms associated with menopause, specifically hot flashes and sleeplessness.
You know, there are not good studies on this at all. But on the other hand, if you look at the web at things that women have used when you're going through menopause with hot flashes, you find a whole bunch of different things. There's randomness to the hot flashes, as far as we can tell. But I think that hot flashes can be set off from, just like migraine headaches, can be set off by diet. And so, you know, you want to find the dietary triggers. Now, there may be things like chocolate and alcohol that might be dietary triggers. It might be things such as chili flakes that we just used in our recipe. But you have to be careful, because you want to experiment with this. And if you find, for instance, that white wine sets it off, because a number of women in my practice have said, I can drink red wine, but I can't drink white wine. And then I have other women who said, I can drink white wine, but I can't drink red wine. You have to then periodically see if every single time you do it, you get a hot flash. Because otherwise, you may narrow yourself into a corner where you stop eating a lot of things you like, when in fact, there's randomness to what's going on. So, are you taking any natural things, valerian root or anything else for this, or black cohosh?
No, I haven't tried any of that. That was going to be my next, to see if you knew of any natural remedies that would work.
Well, what I like, the place that I always go for remedies like this, I like to go to consumerlab.com. And the reason is, I think they're a great website. They test things to make sure they're actually there. They're my go-to website. They cost money because it's like Consumer Reports. There's no advertising. And I would go and look at things such as black cohosh. You could also just put on their, in their dialogue box, menopause, and they'll go through all of the things that are recommended for menopause. But not only that, they'll tell you which ones actually they've tested have it in there. So if you wanted to look at black cohosh, for instance, there's some companies that have no black cohosh in there. It's on the label, but maybe there's a milligram or two. And other companies where they tested and really had all the black cohosh in there that you need. So I would go to consumerlab.com. I don't get any money from this, by the way. Look over the scientific data, because he's great. He goes over all the scientific data, if there is, on menopausal products, for instance. And then he'll tell you which ones they tested work. And then he also tells you how much it costs per milligram. Hmm. And then go to the cheapest one. You'll save the money when you buy the first product. Otherwise, you go to the store and you go, I don't know which one to do. And you end up going to the label that's best, or the one that says, hey, I took it and it worked. You want to use science behind this. So I'd go to consumerlab.com. Pick out some natural products and see if that works. That's what I would do.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your program.
You're welcome. Well, we're also going to put their link on our website.
And we really appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, a listener with us now in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Hi.
Howdy, guys. I have a very interesting biomechanism that when it starts to become late throughout the evening, my body gets overactive and I start getting hives. And sometimes the hives can be life-threatening, and they cause my tongue to swell up and my throat to close. I've been hospitalized a couple of times.
Oh, wow.
I haven't been. In case to get the adrenaline rush and to open up the airways, then I have to go to the hospital. But since I was a kid, I've been taking Sirtec, and the active ingredient is Sirtacine that keeps my symptoms at bay, but it isn't the permanent solution.
No, it's not. I assume that they have done a bunch of allergy testing. Is that right?
Yes. I found out I was allergic to bees.
Of course. But you're not stung when you get this, I assume. This just happens randomly.
Well, it's pretty predictable. Late in the evening, I start to get really irritated, itchy. Then I start getting these welts all over my body. Sometimes when I was younger, they'd be 3x3 patches.
This is a very difficult problem. You know, people who have idiopathic hives, the idiopathic means we don't know what causes them, especially idiopathic hives that then lead to a full, almost anaphylactic shock type reaction where we can't figure out what's going on, is a very difficult problem.
That is the truth.
I don't have a lot of insight into this. I mean, there's research that's going on as to what it is. Zyrtec is a very good antihistamine, you know, and the real issue is following the allergist recommendations of Zyrtec. Diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl, of course, is a stronger antihistamine, but it's hard to take that because it makes you tired. So this has gone on for many years for you.
Yes, ever since I came to Romania. I came from Romania, came to America at 3. I'm 27 now, so 24 years of consistency of idiopathic hives.
By the way, you don't have a Romanian accent at all.
Mult mulțumesc.
Thanks. so you speak Romanian. I think the important thing is having a good allergist, having a good immunologist that you're working with all the time, making sure you have an EpiPen, an adrenaline pen on you, making sure you have people around you who know what they're doing is very important. And if you're not sure, getting a second opinion sometimes at a reference site, Mayo Clinic, university site can also be useful. But right now, the idiopathic hive issue has not been solved. And we have research that's on it because it can be a life-threatening issue, such as it is in your
Other
case.
People have this too?
Idiopathic hives are actually common, but idiopathic hives to the point where you're where basically your windpipe is shut off are not that common. But I have a number of patients who have idiopathic hives, and they've had it for years, and then they disappear. And allergy testing has not shown anything. Yeah. No, this is not – I can assure you this is not uncommon. This actually is not a rare thing. But the rareness is the fact that you have to get to the hospital and do
the severity level. Okay.
Correct. There's research going on it. There's lots of research because we don't understand it. It's mediated by a bunch of things, including certain blood cells called eosinophils, certain white blood cells. So there may be something for you in the future. Being on Muconolast, which is another drug that allergists often use for this, having a good allergist is really your key.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful. My old allergist was having issues diagnosing. I'm just glad that I'm not alone. And you've created some relief to my senses.
My pleasure.
That's nice.
And get a good, when your old allergist retires or if you're not pleased, getting a second opinion from a good allergist who's new and up to date is somebody who's you're going to want to follow with this, because there is new research coming out all the time. And you want a doctor who's excited about this and is going to stay on top of the literature in case something new comes out.
We really appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Before the break now, Zorba, time to belly up to the bench and unholster your official plastic gavel.
It's not plastic. It's Onks. I think it's Onks, whatever Onks is.
Look plastic to me. This is the segment we call Judge Zorba.
There's my gavel.
The following email came to us from John in Amherst, New York. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Zorba. Love your show. I've been a runner for about 30 years, and I'm in good health. I used to run about 15 miles a week. Now I've cut back to about 8 to 10, spread out over 3 runs a week. Recently, I was at a presentation by a cardiologist who cautioned me about continuing my running. He was concerned about runners developing knee and hip problems, so he advised I switch to fast walking. My knees are certainly stiffer than they used to be, and occasionally my knees do ache for a couple of days, but then the ache disappears. But I love running. I found articles that say there's nothing wrong with running into your old age and to ignore the myths that running damages your knees and others that echo this cardiologist's warnings. So what do you think?"
I think he's right. The cardiologist is wrong. And I'll explain why. Mm-hmm. First of all, you don't go to cardiologists to find out about your knees and hips.
Yeah, that's true.
Come on. It's about your heart. Second of all, what does a cardiologist know about knees and hips? They look at their heart, so they may look at the literature. But basically, it's a myth among many doctors that you're continuing to sort of derange your hips and knees. Because the answer is, for some people, they can run well into old age. Now, can you do marathons when you're in your 70s? Some can do it. Some can't do it. It's really a function of your family history. If you have a bunch of people who have bad arthritis in your family, they've needed hip replacements and they could hardly walk, well, then you may want to think a little bit about giving up running and doing fast walking. But if your knees are good and your hips are good and you feel good, why not do it? Because I've got to tell you something. If you're prone to arthritis, you're going to get it, whether you run or not. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen to you. And then this idea of, oh, I've damaged my knees because I've run for 20 or 30 years. I got to tell you, there are a lot of people who never run at all, and they get arthritis too. Yeah. So I think this is a cardiologist myth. And once again, I'm going to put my gavel on. One for you, zero for cardiology.
Have a question you'd like to run by the good doc? Just post it on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org, and I put my heart into every answer.
Another topic to talk about, along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number is 800-462-7413, but Zorba, before our next call, vaping.
Right. Vaping, as you know, Tom, I have been reticent to recommend vaping to stop smoking since it ever began. Mm-hmm. And I've also been reticent to think that vaping is safe. And mm-hmm. the reason is we don't know the long-term evidence of whether or not, you know, inhaling this stuff into your lungs is good. We know the recent evidence that shows that if you vape and you also vape marijuana, you know, the equivalent of marijuana, THC, that it causes pneumonia and has caused deaths and has mm-hmm. caused lung problems. Mm-hmm. But the question is, what about vaping, you know, Juul, J-U-U-L, mm-hmm. e-cigarettes, and they're not regulated by the FDA, so we don't know what's actually in them. We have an idea of what's in them. There's obviously nicotine, because nicotine is addictive, and companies put nicotine in them because mm-hmm. it satisfied the nicotine craving, and it produces it. You look at the number of teenagers who are now vaping, it's astronomically gone up incredibly fast by what we call logs. It's just a terrible, awful thing. So let's look at this particular study, which actually shows that vaping might really be really, really bad for you. American Journal of Preventive Medicine, once again, we don't have 20-year data because data has not been out for 20 years, but they looked at data from roughly 30,000 adults, asking them, this is the health professional study, whether or not they had any respiratory diseases. They also looked at, did they ever use e-cigarettes? Did they smoke? Are they smoking and using e-cigarettes? There are a number of people who use e-cigarettes to cut down on smoking. So they say, well, I'm vaping during the day, and I only have one or two cigarettes at night. You know, mm-hmm. so it's a dual yeah. user, meaning you're smoking and using. And that, of course, is not uncommon. And it turns out the risk of developing lung disease of any sort, pneumonia, bronchitis, elements of COPD, is increased in smokers. We know that by a number of 1.3. Increased in people who vape. It appears that they also are much more likely to have pneumonia and bronchitis and maybe have preliminary COPD. And if used both, it's increased dramatically. So in other words, vaping and smoking might be worse than just smoking.
Yeah.
That's the shocking data that comes from the study.
And just vaping is also awful.
Is also a risk factor. And part of the reason may be when you're actually vaping, you're actually producing these very teeny tiny ultrafine particles that go into the deep parts of your lungs. In other words, when you're smoking, you're actually taking tobacco, you're burning it, and the particles are of a certain size. But when you're vaping, it actually is producing a much finer particle that is coming from the liquid that is going into the lungs and damaging it. So The FDA has been asleep at the wheel. We know that. And the reason was the vaping industry pushed the FDA to the point where they were not allowed to regulate anything. And the reality is vaping is bad. Vaping should be regulated. If you vape, you should stop.
1-800-462-7413, our number. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I have Barrett's esophagus without dysplasia, and I had an endoscopy 2 years ago and discovered this. I had another endoscopy 2 weeks ago, and I haven't gotten results from the doctor yet as far as a talk with him, but I did get the paperwork, and now it seems to be Barrett's stage CO-MI. So I assumed it has moved forward some.
Maybe.
I have a small hiatal hernia, too.
It may have moved before. So Barrett's esophagus, when you look down in the esophagus, it turns out it's an abnormality that has that may predict you may develop esophageal cancer. When I say may, it's because we know that it's a risk factor. Kind of like colon polyps can be a risk factor for colon cancer. If you have, if it ends up you've had a gastroscopy to look at your esophagus and we find it, what we do is we reduce acid in the stomach. Are you on omeprazole or another PPI inhibitor?
Yes, I'm on omeprazole, and I take it once in the evening, 20 milligram, and then I was taking ritidine, but they put me on another medicine for in the morning because they recalled that Zantac.
Right. They recalled the Zantac, so famotidine is really the ones that people are using, which is Pepcid. So you're taking 20 milligrams. So once again, when I say may, it's because this is a pathological determination. It doesn't mean you're going to develop a esophageal cancer. It's more the fact of how often do you actually get scoped to be looked at. And I've looked at the literature on Barrett's esophagitis and how predictable it is. And there's some questionable things of what it is. Sort of like PSA tests. There are people who have, there are men who have prostate cancer. Some of it then grows and becomes prostate cancer, and some of it kind of just remains there and nothing ever happens to it. And it's the same with Barrett's esophagitis. It doesn't, and the Barrett's changes in the esophagus, which are inflammatory, doesn't mean you're going to come down with cancer. It means it's kind of got to be watched. Now, what may also occur is your gastroenterologist may increase the amount of omeprazole that you're on from 20 milligrams once a day to 20 milligrams twice a day. That's one way that it's sort of treated. And once again, it may not mean it's a progression. It may mean it's a change. So the idea of progression means, is this going to increase the risk? It may not be the case. It may be that you just need more drug to reduce the inflammation.
Well, you know, the interesting
thing. You follow what I'm saying. It may not be a risk issue with esophagitis. It might be an inflammation issue in the fact that either you have to be on a different PPI or a higher dose.
Right. Well, I was on a higher dose when they first found this. You know, I've noticed it. Well, I had the endoscopy 2 years ago. But anyway, I do take the shot for Prolia. And so my gastroenterologist said that we have to keep it at 20 because doubling that is too much now. And so I did notice about 2 or 3 months ago when I woke up, I had some blood on my chin and on the sheet. So I went down and told the doctor, and he said, well, how many nights has this been going on? And I said, just one. So he didn't say anything. And so anyway, my primary care doctor said to go ahead and increase it to twice a day for 6 weeks to heal the esophagus. And I went back and I told my GI doctor, and he said, no, that's too much. So I didn't do it.
What are you on the Prolia for?
Osteopenia.
Right. So, I mean, that's a drug that can also cause esophageal and gastric issues. It's a drug that we use for osteoporosis, and it also can produce esophagitis because that can be an issue with those with that drug and the other drugs in that category. So that kind of complicates things.
Yes, you know, doctor, I think this is how I first got this, because when I went through the change, they immediately said I had osteopenia. So they put me on all this medicine, and I kept getting, you know, heartburn from everything.
Yeah.
I must have taken every type under the sun, and I said, I just can't take this anymore. And so I didn't. And so I just think that this is how this whole thing started with me.
Right. I've got some ideas. First of all, how long have you been on the Prolia or other osteoporotic drugs?
Just about 3 shots now.
Over a year and a half, or how long?
Right, a year and a half.
A year and a half. So, first of all, let me tell you about osteopenia. There's mild osteopenia, moderate osteopenia, severe osteopenia. And it turns out that severe osteopenia may develop into osteoporosis. But many with very mild osteopenia, it never develops into osteoporosis. You watch especially women like this over 5, 10, 15, and 20 years, and a certain number progress and do not progress. So my recommendation is you've had 3 shots. This may be the issue. What you want to do is you should have another densitometry examination. Who put you on the Prolia? Was it a rheumatologist or your family doc, or who put you on it?
No, my endocrinologist, because I take a thyroid medication.
Uh-huh. I would question whether or not you need the Prolia. And what I would do if it were me, or if it were my wife, is number one, I would say, I've had 3 shots. I think I'm having side effects. I want to have a densitometry examination. It's been roughly 2 years, year and a half, 2 years, using the same machine with the same protocol. Very important. I want to know whether or not there's a difference. Is my osteopenia getting worse, or is it the same? Then I would want to know, is it mild, moderate, or severe? And if it's mild, I would say, show me the data that actually shows this is important. Because there's some doctors who will look at it and say, oh, you've got osteopenia, we've got to step in right away. When in fact, if it's mild and you're having side effects, I wouldn't step in. Because that may be causing your esophagitis and the blood that you spit up, and may be causing your Barrett's, and may not be worth it. And the second thing I would do is, if that doctor said, no, I think so, I think it's, even though it's mild, I recommend it, I'd get a second opinion. Because I think you may be right, that's the problem. You may be receiving medication that you don't need. You need to look at this, need to get a second opinion. And if it's mild osteopenia and you're having side effects, it may be overkill. Good luck.
Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate all your information.
Good luck.
And we appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
You know, this is a perfect example of where a second opinion needs to come in, and you've got to balance the art of medicine. This woman has trouble with her esophagus. She may be on a medicine she doesn't need. You've got to make a thoughtful thought, and then with that information, she has to make the decision. And the decision is not black and white at all. It is gray.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Zorba, time now for our medical Mythbuster segment. The following email came to us from Seneca, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Zorba, could you give some facts about the new shingles shot? There are lots of stories going around about it. I've heard that the needle is much bigger than the normal needle because the vaccine is thick and requires a big needle. Also, that the nurse has to forcefully jab the needle in your arm. Ouch. And that after the shot, you get sick with a very sore arm for days, headaches, and fever chills. Yikes. And that the second shot is even worse. You just can't win. Are these just myths? I plan to get the shot regardless, but could you address some of these stories? I got an earful today at my hairdresser."
First of all, the shingle shot, you do get a little pain after the shingle shot. Some injections cause more pain. Tetanus shots are a good example. The influenza shot doesn't cause any pain. Small needle, small amount. Shingle shot, more goes into your arm, so it's a little bit more painful. And then there usually is a local reaction. There isn't fever. There isn't chills. Mm-hmm. Very few people have any negative response to it. I don't really know if the needle is bigger than the needle that we actually give for the influenza shot. I know the liquid that goes in there a little more. I haven't had patients complain at all. The real issue is, if you've had chicken pox, you're at risk for shingles.
Hmm.
If you decide you want to reduce the risk, get the shingles shot. If you're afraid of getting shots and you're afraid that this giant needle 2 feet long is going into your arm and the nurse jabs into the arm and goes, ha, 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 I'm going to push this into your arm. Come on. There's myth involved. The reality is it does sting a bit when it goes in. It does not cause fever and chills in 95% of the population. It's incredibly well tolerated, and there is a 95% chance you're not going to get shingles. I've got a distinct recommendation. Don't get your medical advice under the hairdryer.
Yeah. I got both shingles shots. I couldn't tell the difference.
I got the shingles shot. I couldn't tell the difference either. It felt like a flu shot, and I never had any pain. I'm not going to, you know what? I'm not going to that hairdresser. That's what I'm going to do.
Have a potential myth for Zorba. He's happy to give it a shot. Oh. Just post on our Facebook page, or you can always send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
And before we head out today, Zorba, let's fire up another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. The following email came to us from a listener named Becky in Depew, New York. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I'm a little disturbed by your advice to the person with dry eyes. It sounds like you are recommending heating the eye drops instead of the compress in the microwave. I doubt that putting eye drops into one's eyes have been heated that long would be beneficial. I fear you should make that clear immediately. Thanks for your wonderful advice, and I read you every week."
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you. Let me clarify that. Do not heat the eye drops. You don't want to put hot eye drops in your eye. You put the eye drop in your eye, moisturizing eye drop or gel in your eye, followed, if you can, with a warm, moist compress. It doesn't really have to be moist. It can be something you heat up in the microwave. That's the way to do it. Don't heat the eye drops. Hot drops in your eyes? Okay.
Do you not always see eye to eye with Zorba? Let us know by posting on our Facebook page or by sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brian Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Did you miss something on today's show? Simply go to ZorbaPastor.org to catch up on all things Zorba. There you will find recipes from the show, links to the Facebook page, Zorba's Healthy Living articles, and you can subscribe to the weekly podcast. On the web, that's ZorbaPastor.org.